Welcome to the 7:30 half hour of Good Morning Ozarks. Keith O'Neill and Sheila Art this morning on the 29th of January, 2007. Whew, I'm still having trouble saying 7 once in a while.
Well, the month's gone. You better get used to it.
I know. Man, somebody asked me they were talking about Christmas the other day.
Christmas this coming year?
Yeah, it's next year. Well, by the way, yesterday, you know what we did yesterday?
Took our Christmas tree down. Well, yeah.
Took the Christmas tree down. So, anyway, Christmas will be here in less than 11 months, I guess.
So you could have just left it up.
Yeah. It will be the first one on our block to have Christmas tree up, I guess. Why not?
Hey, as fast as life goes anymore, just enjoy the tree.
Isn't that for sure? Hey, Friday, you all had a question here, and I did not get caught up on it. So would you give it to us, please?
We were talking about clouds last week.
Oh, really?
And the question was, whoever watches the wind will not plant, and whoever looks at the clouds will not. Do you know?
Reap. Whoever
plant and reap. Yeah. That was found in Ecclesiastes 11:4.
Really? Huh.
Ecclesiastes sometimes is one of those books that you don't know a whole lot about.
Uh-huh.
A lot of wisdom in it.
Oh, absolutely.
But, yeah.
Well, today we start a whole new week of questions. Let's see. This was Dens.
Dreams,
Dens, and
Deliverance. You kind of stutter on that.
Dreams, Dens, and Deliverance.
Right.
Which king ordered
Daniel? Now you're confused.
Yeah, now, wait a minute. Who was it? Who did go in?
Yeah.
Daniel.
Yeah.
Which king ordered Daniel to go and be put into the lion's den? If you know, you call 334-5532 or 1-877-334-5532.
And I would suggest that you look it up because you'll probably guess incorrectly if you're to guess.
Yeah.
And just have a feeling.
And if you think about it the way I asked the question of David going in, you're going to really be messed up.
Yeah, really can be confused. That's
mm-hmm.
right.
So, which king ordered Daniel in the lion's den?
Right.
Hey, we have a pastor with us today.
We do.
You have been visiting with him, so introduce Chuck to us.
We have Chuck Silva, who's pastor of the Horizon Christian Church, and he just told me they've been a church for about 2 years now.
Wow, Chuck,
yes, that's
good morning.
Correct. Good morning to you.
Hey, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Keith.
Before we find out all about church and what the congregation's doing and you know, all that, let's go back a little bit and get to know you and tell us what part of the country did you were born and grew up in and how you came to find the Lord, and then we'll end up here in Branson at some point.
Well, Keith, I started my life in San Diego, California.
Where I just flew into and out of. And they were whining. You would understand this. It was going to be 58, 59 degrees, and they thought it was dead of winter.
Dead of winter.
So you understand that.
Yes, I do. out there, it's always usually year-round 60, 70 at the worst of it.
Right.
So it's not a bad place to grow up.
Well, not a bad place to grow up at all, San Diego.
I was one of those that had a fortunate childhood. I grew up one block off of San Diego Bay. So I spent most of my childhood was spent in the water on San Diego Bay whenever I wasn't in school.
Well, I probably went right by your house then because that's where the ships are docked there and we cruised out of San Diego.
Yes, you would have.
Wow. And they had the Maritime Museum there. Did they have that when you were still out there, I guess? There's an aircraft carrier there, a submarine you can go through, an old sailing ship.
That's all. The old sailing ship has been there for years, Star of India, down on the Embarcadero.
Right.
Those others are additions that are since I've left.
Huh. Okay, so grew up in San Diego.
Grew up in San Diego, met my high school sweetheart, Tempa, and she's a native of the Branson area, born and raised here.
Mm-hmm.
And we met in high school. Her dad was in the Navy out there. And I knew a good thing. When we got out of school, I didn't let her get away.
Ah, that's good. That's great.
So we married and made our home there in San Diego. I had grown up in the tuna fishing industry. I was a fisherman for Starkist Tuna. And evolved out of San Diego. Sorry, Charlie.
I didn't know that there was a fishing industry out of San Diego.
That's where the fishing industry was born. There and up in San Pedro, California, mm-hmm. is the American tuna fishing industry.
Wow.
And did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Starkist was based out of San Pedro, and most of their fleet was out of San Diego with Portuguese-American families running those fleets. And so I had the privilege of growing up in that industry and worked hard. At my 21st birthday, most people are out celebrating, and I was at the Coast Guard office there in San Diego taking my first engineering license. Was an engineer for Starkist on their ships. And
That should have been a fun job, I would
think. It was a fun job. But as all good things, for me, unfortunately, with the success and the position and the extra money, I started drinking more than I should have. And 1975, it was December of 1975, I came to know Christ as my mm-hmm. personal Savior.
Amen.
How did that come about?
My wife, Tempa, was saying to me, you really need to get some help with your alcoholism. And I, of course, said, well, I'm not really an alcoholic.
Yeah, sure.
Ask me a beer, right?
Yeah, that's right. Give me a beer. I've got a headache this morning. Mm-hmm. Just through my one of my aunts, one of my dad's brother's wives, she was the only Christian in this very large family that we were a part of. And she invited us to church. And my wife's grandmother from the Ozarks here was telling my wife, Tempa, you guys need to come get back to Christ. You need to get to church. And just through a chain of events, I went to church. Mm-hmm. And after several weeks, Pastor Joe was his name, Joe Farrow. He called one Saturday, said, can I come out to the house? I said, I'd be delighted to have you come out to the house. He came out to the house and shared the four spiritual laws with us and mm-hmm. Asked if we'd like to pray to receive Christ. I said, you bet I would. I said, this is the best news I've ever heard in my life.
Amen.
That God sent his son to die for my sin mm-hmm. and that he rose from the dead on the third day just as he said that he would in order that I might have life and forgiveness through him.
Amen.
And we got down on our knees right there. I prayed and invited Christ into my life and that day, that moment, I was delivered from my alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
About a year and a half later, I found myself in Biola Bible College up in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
We sold some properties that we owned and went to Bible college. I took every Bible course they had for a couple of years, and I said to God, where's my church? And he said, right back out there on those tuna boats.
Wow.
And went back into the tuna industry and had an active evangelistic ministry for close to 20 years on those ships, ministering Christ to those men, and then when we would get home from our trips, being able to have the privilege of leading their families, their wives and children to Christ as well.
Wow. That's, and we've talked recently, there's a real move back into marketplace ministry. So many people have thought of ministry as being, like myself, my husband, I, we've been in full-time ministry 37 years now, and they think that that's the only ministry there is, but really, the workplace is the greatest place of ministry, don't you think?
Absolutely. In fact, Ephesians chapter 4, Paul instructs us that we as pastors are to equip the people to go out into the workday world and win the people to Christ.
Equip the saints for the work of the ministry.
That's right. To equip radio talk show hosts to be exalting Jesus Christ in Branson and beyond.
Well, you spend so much time at work with colleagues, in the workplace and around the water cooler and all. And if you could be just a witness to those people and have an opportunity to share with them, and especially they bring some problems to work and just a great opportunity for the Lord just to work through you. And so you did that on the boats. How long are you out at a time on a ship?
Anywhere from 30 to 60 days. These ships, when we talk of a ship, it's not as large as that tour ship you were just on.
Yeah, that's about 900 and something feet long. I mean, that's big.
The tuna ships are around 260 feet long.
That's pretty good
size. And they carry, the average tuna ship carried 1,200 ton of yellowfin tuna. And I was on one as large as 1,800 ton of yellowfin tuna. And after landing a job on that ship, I thought, I must be crazy. Where are we ever going to catch this much fish?
Yeah.
But we actually did. We'd be out 30 to 60 days, Keith.
How far out did they go?
I ended up at the end of my career, we were over in the southwestern Pacific around Fiji, Truk, Australia, New Zealand. We were based out of the island of Guam. And Starkist actually had a processing plant, and they still do to this day, on the island of American Samoa.
Hmm.
So we ended up my last several years of tuna fishing in the South Pacific, the far western South Pacific, catching yellowfin tuna.
Now, they do that with big nets, right?
Yes, we have a large net. It's called a seine net, and we wrap the entire school of tuna. And the newer ships have just super hydraulic systems on them with extreme power and speed to be able to close that net underneath those tuna, because they have fins and tails and they'll dive right underneath that net. The water is crystal clear out there in the southwestern Pacific. So it's tough to catch them, but you keep trying. You let that net out four, five, six times a day. And every once in a while you get lucky or the good Lord smiles down on you. And you get a school of fish that will be on bait that will keep them up on the surface so we can get the net closed underneath them.
Big is a tuna?
The average tuna, they're all different sizes, of course, from babies to big tunas. But the ones that we were primarily after were anywhere from 60 to 150 to 200 pounds.
My goodness.
So they're rather large.
Can you imagine how much that weighs?
Well, that's what I'm thinking. What kind of hydraulic system you've got to lift them straight up.
When you got a net full of that big of tunas?
I have a question. How do you keep the fish fresh?
That was going to be one of my questions. What happens now? You catch this big net of tuna. Do you have, like, coolers, or do they clean them, or do they, I mean?
No, we catch the fish live, and the fish, of course, die as we begin drying the net up underneath them. They can't swim, so without water through their gills, they die. Mm-hmm. And then we have a big scoop called a brailer that holds 2 to 3 ton of yellowfin tuna. And we have another work boat that comes alongside and takes one end of the net, and then we dry the net up until the fish is up. Then we scoop them out with hydraulics out of the net over onto the boat and dump them into a receiver called a hopper, and then it directs the tuna to the lower cargo area, and we have a conveyor system that carries the fish whole into large tanks that are anywhere from 60 to 100 ton of yellowfin tuna in one tank.
Oh, my.
And is that a tank with water? Or
yes, it's seawater that's been refrigerated. We all know what's freezing around here in the Ozarks.
Right, yeah.
31 degrees, right?
Yeah.
Water freezes at 31, as we just learned with this recent ice storm. So we keep our seawater, because it's so heavily salty, we can keep it at 29 degrees, 29 to 30 is freezing. So we put the fish in one of these large tanks, fill the tank up in this salt water until it's completely full of fish, and then we put more 29-degree seawater back in there, because the fish are 80 to 90 degrees temperature.
Yeah.
So we have to get that heat, the heat within the fish themselves, out of the fish.
Now, I didn't realize that. Did you realize that?
No.
The 80 to 90 degrees temperature?
Go fishing with a pole, take the thing, throw it down in the ice box.
They are that warm, that's their body temperature?
Yes, it is. They're very, very warm.
Huh.
And so we have to get all that heat out. And what we used, I think the original question was, how do we keep them fresh?
Yeah.
Or how do we handle them?
Right.
So we have ammonia refrigeration systems with compressors that actually pump the heat out of this tank and take the heat out of the fish until we get it back down to 29, 30 degrees right at freezing. And that takes 12 to 24 hours to do that with just a constant monitoring, because you can't freeze that up or you'll freeze up your compressors.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a real fine line there to bring it down. You bring them, take all that heat out of that tank.
Right.
That tank's completely full and you've got a lid on it. Then you pump in a very heavy concentrated mixture of seawater, which you've added salt to, which lowers by adding salt. What's salt do on our icy sidewalks?
Right.
It melts it.
Uh-huh.
So we add salt in a 100-ton tank of tuna. We would add 100 sacks or so of salt, which would allow us then to take the freezing temperature down below 0 degrees.
Wow. Nice.
So we take this mixture in, which takes just a very little of it. Once that tank is filled with tuna, we pump that 29-degree seawater out. Once we get it to hold at 29 degrees, we pump in this salt mixture, which takes the temperature then down to 0 degrees, and that fish is frozen solid and held like that until we bring it into the cannery.
Wow.
How long from the time approximately that a fish is taken out of the ocean till it ends up in the cannery?
It takes us usually a week to 10 days once we leave, let's say American Samoa.
Mm-hmm.
It would take a week to 10 days to find the fish. I mean, the ocean, just imagine how large the ocean is.
Huge.
So you try to get some information from other boats that are out there that you actually share with. A bunch of pirates most of the time, not catching a thing, and they're loading their boat up. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
But we have a helicopter on the vessel that we use for spotting.
My goodness.
And they know where the other boats are, and so it's usually a week to 10 days to the fishing grounds. And then once you're on the fishing grounds, it can take you 10 days to 40 to 50 days to fill the boat up, just depending on conditions, depending on weather. And once that ship is filled up with yellowfin tuna, we were talking a minute ago about these large tanks.
Yeah.
The ship is divided into starboard and port, left and right, and down the center of this ship is a shaft alley, and on either side are these huge tuna tanks.
Mm.
So there's normally 10 on the right, 10 on the left, and we have to fill all of these tanks with this 1,500 ton of tuna. And once it's filled, then we head back to cannery. So my last couple of years were very prosperous in the South Pacific.
My goodness.
There was a lot of tuna there.
Yeah.
And we were normally out 20, 30, 40 days at a time to fill that boat up. And it was a good time, Keith.
I imagine it was hard work, though, and it probably you had a little different quarters to house the crew in other than like what we had on the cruise ship. Just it's probably not as luxurious, I would say.
Well, you might be surprised that the quarters for myself, the engineer, the captain, there was about four of us on there that would have a stateroom that would equal or surpass the one that you just enjoyed on the cruise ship.
Tough life, but somebody had to do it.
It was a tough life, but somebody's got to do it.
Interesting.
Would there be other – would you just pick up all tuna? How do you know you've got all tuna?
That was the other thing. I was going to say. If you throw a net out there, don't you get things other than tuna? And what do you do with them?
Well, if you're real lucky, every once in a while you'll get a swordfish. And one of those that I love is mahi-mahi.
Oh, yeah.
So you will get mahi-mahi, and we separate those out and clean them and put them in our freezer.
Yeah, there you go.
To be able to eat fresh on the barbecue or baked.
Mm.
We get a lot of sharks.
Really?
And contrary to opinion, those sharks will eat anything that hits the water.
Oh.
So we have to separate those out. And I talked earlier about that large hopper that sits on the main deck of the ship.
Uh-huh.
Well, when that large scoop comes up with a 2 to 3 ton of tuna, there may be a couple sharks in that.
Yeah.
Well, we dump that big scoop, or brailer we call it, into this big hopper, this big receiver. And then you can sort out the tuna, mahi-mahi, and shark so that only yellowfin tuna goes down below.
Wow.
And they travel in schools.
Sure.
So
now, does the shark prey on the tuna? Is that his dinner?
Well, he'll prey on. He's a scavenger, and he'll prey on anything he can get his hands on.
Huh.
And so they eat themselves full while they're in the net, where the tuna are a captive audience. They get stuck in the net, and the sharks will come up and eat on them.
My goodness!
So
what do you end up doing with the shark?
We throw them back over the side.
Do they die at the same time with
they
the
do?
Tuna?
They yes.
Do. Huh. Interesting. So then somebody else comes along and eats the shark.
A bigger shark eats the shark.
Bigger shark. Huh.
Well, yeah, don't you remember Charlie could never make it in the school, I think it was a problem.
Yeah, he was too small of a tuna or something of that nature. Wasn't there a big deal a while back, and we will get to church talk here in just a second, but kind of fascinating about this tuna operation. Wasn't there a situation a while back where everybody was talking about getting dolphins caught in those nets?
Yes, that was unfortunately a political issue that was
of course
politicized.
It was politicized by those that wanted to protect the dolphin, and no one wanted to protect the dolphin more than the American tuna fishermen.
I'm sure that's true.
And so we developed one of the tuna captains by the name of Medina developed what we call the Medina panel, and it was netting that had a small enough and heavy enough mesh to where the dolphins couldn't get their noses. Stuck in the net at that portion of the net, and we would roll half of our net back on the ship, tie the net down, and back the boat up very slowly, and it would create a long channel, and then the net would sink on that far end and go down, and all the dolphin would go right out because they just float on the surface.
Uh-huh.
So we worked very hard at saving the dolphin and keeping them from trouble. And very few people ever really understood all of that.
Right.
It was politicized.
Oh, sure.
We had inspectors on every one of the American tuna fishing vessels, had a young oceanographer from one of the colleges here in the United States would travel with us on our ship and keep a record of the number of porpoise that were actually killed. And it was very seldom. If you ran into bad weather or had a breakdown with your equipment, there was the occasional disaster. But for the most part, those are smart animals, and we would actually go in the water with them. Before I became an engineer, I was in the water with the dolphins helping them out of the net.
My goodness. Now, I'm thinking, Keith, while he's talking about all this expense, all the equipment, the technology, you know, two for a dollar tuna fish cans are pretty good.
That's a great deal.
I noticed that on our cruise down the western coast of Mexico, which we were not way out in open seas or so, had a little GPS with us, and I think we got like 30-something miles offshore but at the closest. But you guys are out there in the middle of bobbing around with nothing around
for miles.
What was the weather like? Did you ever get into any rough seas? Was there a time when you said, Lord, I'm sure glad I know you now.
My poor little wife, Tempa, we shanghaied her and the captain's wife back in 1982. You may recall that giant hurricane that hit the Hawaiian Islands.
Oh, sure.
In 1982.
Yes.
Well, it hit us first, Keith.
Really?
My wife became a prayer warrior, praying her way off of that ship.
Huh.
And we were in such severe weather. You've heard stories of it, or if you've ever watched Perfect Storm or any of those TV series, or if you saw the movie The Perfect Storm.
Right. We did.
We were in that type of a situation.
Wow.
And it actually, we were running dead slow into the storm, and it was so violent. Mm. It was one of the worst storms I've ever been in. Three rogue, what we call rogue waves, which you saw in The Perfect Storm, which was a little bit, I think, overemphasized. Mm-hmm. However,
that
like actually 50 feet tall or something?
That was. Well, we got some that were about 30 foot tall, and they hit our ship. There was three of them in a row, and that's how rogue waves usually come. And they hit us and knocked all of the windows out of the pilot house up topside, filled the interior of the ship with water, and I thought we were going to go down. That's how bad it was. Mm-hmm. Knocked out the engines. I told my wife, Tempa, get this life jacket on and you wait here and I'll be back. And I ran down, was able to restart the engines. We were able to get the ship turned around, running into the storm. But it was just a horrendous storm. And as I say, that hit us to the south, to the southwest of the Hawaiian Islands before it came on in and did such devastation to the islands.
Boy, so that was your responsibility as engineer to
keep things running.
To keep things, wow.
We don't realize, Sheila, out here on Table Rock, you know,
right.
We get a little bit of wind and all, and even on cruise ships, they always stay in nice calm weather and stuff like that, but we don't realize that these fishing vessels do get out in some high seas and some heavy winds.
Yes, they do.
Mm. Wow. Huh. So that gets you from San Diego. More with Fishing with Chuck.
Yeah. It is interesting.
Yeah, it is. How do we get then from San Diego to Branson? Imagine that's easy after coming off a ship like that, and your wife says, hey, they don't have that bed home. Let's go.
Actually, Tempa's parents live here in the Ozarks, and her grandparents, of course, have gone on to be with the Lord. But if you think of Point Royal out here, that was my wife Tempa's grandfather, Everett Fawcett, that was his farm.
Really?
Point Royal. He worked that farm all of his life. And
I've seen that name.
Everett Fawcett.
Yeah,
there's
Fawcett.
A lot of Fawcetts in these hills.
Exactly.
So in 1982, my in-laws were our babysitters. So if I was to Shanghai Tempa on the ship with me, which I did a couple of times, and she would regularly come to visit me in my port of call in Guam or American Samoa or Panama or Puerto Rico, wherever we happen to be, Tempa would have to fly to the job. And the kids being little and so forth, her mom would watch our kids for us.
So in 82, Branson seemed a better option.
Well, 1982, my father-in-law, as I say, was in the Navy
in
San Diego, California. He retired from the Navy and moved home. And so my mother-in-law made one trip to San Diego after that to watch our kids, and she said, I'm not doing this no more. If God wanted me to fly, he would have given me feathers. I don't like those airplanes. You want me to babysit, you move home.
Yeah.
And so in 1982, we moved home to Branson, and we've been here ever since.
Oh, and so you've lived here since 82. Wow.
After that storm, the Tempa was on the ship with you, did she go back? Or was that her last voyage?
She came back, but not on another voyage, I don't believe.
Huh. Yeah, that would kind of cure you.
Yeah. So you permanently moved to Branson,
in 1982.
You gave up your fishing
No,
career?
I continued fishing until 1992.
92, wow. Okay.
And that might be a good transition of what I'm doing today.
Sure.
Right.
In 1993, I retired from Starkist Tuna. Over the years, I had finished that Bible degree that I began back there in the 70s at Biola College.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I finished that over the years with Jerry Falwell through Liberty University's Extension Program. And so in 94, out at College of the Ozarks, I took the last class that I needed to finish my college degree. And God then called, I felt God calling me to further training for Christian ministry. Mm-hmm. And I received a flyer, one of those God things, in the mail from Dallas Theological Seminary. And one of our former pastors, after we had first been saved out in California, was Dr. Richard Strauss of Emmanuel Faith Community Church in Escondido, California. That was our discipleship church, if you will.
Yeah.
And after studying with Dr. Strauss, I found out he was from Dallas Seminary. So I thought, well, I received this flyer in the mail. We began to pray about it. Right about that time, I had retired from Starkist Tuna. And my wife, Tempa, had always said, you raise the kids, and then I'll go anywhere you want to go to serve the Lord. And our kids, by that point, were both married by 94. So we applied, passed the entrance exams, and headed for Dallas Seminary, maintaining our home here in Branson. We went on down to Dallas, and I finished a 4-year theologian master's degree at Dallas. Came back, taught at College of the Ozarks for a year as an adjunct professor. And Dr. Courtney Furman out at the college was the head of the chair of the department at that time.
Right.
And he said, our students love you, we love you, but you need a PhD. And I said, I don't even want to hear that. I can't do a PhD. Yeah. And he said, sure you can. If you want to really teach God's word, you need further training.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't imagine that, Sheila.
Yeah.
But I prayed about it, took the entrance exams, which were tough. Made it back into Dallas Seminary, and just this last May, I graduated with my PhD in Bible from Dallas Theological Seminary. And that's how the church, you would ask me, Keith, how this church got started.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, doing several Bible studies, I had finished all my coursework at Dallas for the PhD. We had moved back home to Branson, and then I had 2 years under my belt of research, reading, writing, my doctoral dissertation, mm-hmm. which I wrote on the book of Hosea, by the way.
Oh, it's a great book.
Hmm.
God's eternal love for us, no matter how bad we get, God still loves us.
Sure.
Yeah.
So we finished that up this last May, and just in the process, the first year we went into the K-Life building downtown. We met in one of the large rooms upstairs, and this last Christmas a year ago, I challenged our people as we began to grow, you fill this room and we'll find a bigger place. God will provide. And they filled the room by February of a year ago. We were praying about it, myself and the elders. And so we approached Dot Crane, who runs K-Life. And she said, well, why don't you just move into the gymnasium? So we invested about $40,000, put heating and air conditioning in that old gymnasium. And we set it up on Sunday and tear it down. And that's where we're currently having our church services. And we're looking forward to filling that building here. We're up to about 60 right now and hoping to fill that for 2 services on Sunday mornings.
Right. Well, Chuck, we want to ask if you can stick around just a little bit. We got news coming up next. Would that be all right?
That'd be great.
Well, cast your net out and let's see what we catch here in the next few minutes, and we'll be back and we'll continue. Your question today is, which king authorized that Daniel be put in the lion's den? 334-5532 or 1-877-334-5532. We're going to continue with Chuck and Sheila and I in just a moment on Good Morning Ozarks here on KLFC Branson, Life FM. It's time for news and weather next. Sheila, you want to go out and buy some tuna?
Yeah.
We'll be back. Stay tuned.